This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك إنك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russian forces encircle four major Ukrainian cities and get closer to the capital, Kiev, on the 16th day of their offensive there. Iran's foreign minister says a good and durable agreement on the revival of the JCPOA is within reach if the US acts realistically and consistently. Also in the headlines, the US says North Korea has recently used intercontinental ballistic missiles in two secretive launches, calling it a serious escalation. Thank you for joining us. And our top story, the key battleground developments on day 16 of Russia's multi-pronged offensive in Ukraine. Russian forces are encircling at least four major cities and getting closer to the capital, Kiev. In eastern Ukraine, the city of Kharkiv is likely surrounded, though still in the Ukrainian government's hands. The city of Sumy in northeast is already encircled by Russian troops, but thousands of locals have been able to leave through a humanitarian corridor. In the capital, in the north, the capital Kiev remains under heavy bombardment, with a column of Russian armored vehicles massing outside the city. However, reports suggest the column is suffering losses. In the south, Russia has besieged the strategic city of Mariupol and attempts to evacuate an estimated 200,000 civilians from the city. Russian forces last week took the southern city of Kherson, and there is heavy fighting for control of the city of Mykolaiv. Our correspondent Robert Carter joined us earlier to talk about the influx of Ukrainian refugees that have been fleeing to Poland. He says the country has received the largest share of refugees and will be facing a huge battle to shelter these people.
Well over a million people are now inside, are inside Poland right now. So it's a huge uphill battle that Poland is facing to try and cater for all of these new guests. In fact, I have a statistic which suggests, it was published by the Wall Street Journal today, that up to two Ukrainian refugees are entering Poland every 3 seconds right now. So that's just how serious the the situation is. Obviously, Poland is a country which traditionally doesn't like to take in refugees, as we've seen from their handling of African or Middle Eastern refugees in past crises. They prefer to keep them out. But on this occasion, they've opened their doors and they're now trying to handle this influx of mass people, this mass movement that has occurred. So obviously the situation here, Poland is facing its own battle with the refugee situation, but the situation inside Ukraine is intensifying. And obviously reports are coming in thick and fast of continued fighting and bomb attacks and things like that. And obviously the capital, Kiev, is it's a hot spot for that violence. And the more the violence inside Ukraine escalates, more refugees from other parts of the country start to look to leave. And of course, the majority of them are heading to Poland.
Tensions between the United States and Russia over Ukraine take on new aspects, with the two sides now locked in a dispute over alleged bio labs in Ukraine. Russia has accused the US of financing a Ukrainian biological program involving deadly pathogens for military purposes. Washington denies that, calling the accusation gaslighting. The US says the Russian claim is in line with its false flag efforts that Washington has warned before. The government in Kiev has also denied any such program on Ukrainian soil. Now the UN Security Council is set to convene later on Friday to discuss the issue. The meeting will be held at the request of Russia. And the European Union leaders dismiss Ukraine's appeal for rapid accession to the bloc.
There is a request for a candidate membership from Ukraine, and that is now in process, and we have fast-tracked the sending it on to the Commission earlier this week by the Council. That's one, but that will take time, months, maybe years before you get to anything.
Except Eastern Germany in times of Helmut Kohl, nobody entered the European Union overnight.
Ukraine applied for fast EU membership shortly after Russia began its military operation there on February 24. Ukraine's neighbors on the EU's eastern flank back Kiev's rapid membership, but others like the Netherlands say for now what is important is that Ukraine has made the demand. On Thursday, EU leaders met in France to discuss further support to Ukraine in the face of the ongoing Russian offensive. They also discussed how to reduce their reliance on Russian energy. Already high fuel prices have soared in Europe in recent days in the wake of sanctions on the Russian energy sector. So the heads of the European Union have met in the suburbs of the French capital to discuss the ongoing crisis between Russia and Ukraine. In response to the crisis, Europe is considering sweeping changes which could create historic impacts, specifically, on the continent's energy sector. Rami Mazahari has more from Paris.
At the Palace of Versailles, famed as the seat of absolute autocracy and anti-democracy, the leaders of the European Union met in order to discuss possibly historic reversals of long-standing policies as a response to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
The challenge is to leave the summit with a firm declaration that a peak of new sanctions is reached, that they will be applied, and that everyone is ready to move towards the same decisions, such as freezing assets of both the Russian central bank and private banks, sanctions on those close to Europe, and reducing gas purchases.
Russia is the biggest supplier of fossil fuels to the European Union, and the meeting will discuss how to reduce as much as two-thirds of its natural gas needs from Russia within a year. That is expected to be extremely painful for businesses and households, and would force a reversal of green energy policies, which many European politicians have insisted were of apocalyptic importance for many years. One of the key arguments often used to defend the EU is that it is responsible for an era of European peace. But many say the two-day conference may provide the foundations for a new European army. For the first time, the EU has sent lethal weapons, even though the bloc won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012. More than half of Europe has already sent arms to Ukraine, further escalating the conflict.
Une forme d'autonomie stratégique.
There needs to be a form of strategic autonomy, which Macron keeps repeating. And if not independence, then less dependence from both Washington and Moscow. The consequences of this conflict will be felt on Europe. So Europe needs to show unprecedented unity and swiftness.
To fund these changes, the leaders are discussing a potentially massive bond sale similar to the bloc's $2 trillion COVID rescue fund, and which they refused to do during the age of austerity. The latest round of Russia-Ukraine peace talks in Turkey failed to make any progress at all. The fallout from the conflict in the Ukraine is provoking massive shifts in historical developments and with a rapidity that few imagine possible. If the two countries can't make peace soon, the world may look very different very quickly. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Turning to other news now, negotiations to revive the 2015 landmark Iran deal are underway in Austria's capital. Now, Iran's foreign minister says a good and durable agreement is within reach if the U.S. acts realistically and consistently. In a tweet, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said no single party can determine the end result of the negotiations. He said a joint endeavor is needed to accomplish the Vienna talks. Earlier, the top diplomat rejected what he called the U.S.'s excessive demands, saying they do not have a logical justification. The eighth round of negotiations are now underway in Vienna. Iran says a deal is possible if the West makes necessary decisions. The verifiable removal of sanctions and guarantees that the U.S. does not leave the agreement again are Iran's key demands. It says the deal will not be possible if everything is not agreed upon. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas says Iran's long history of resistance against U.S. sanctions enables it to withstand Washington's excessive demands during the Vienna talks.
But Iran is still being pretty magnanimous in these negotiations, in spite of seeing the American ship sinking very, very steadily before our very eyes. And with the economic collapse coming, you don't know what else is going to happen in terms of the Western situation around their own economic status. Iran is not going to be affected. Iran has been suffering from economic sanctions for decades. They've gone through the most abysmal and abhorrent sanctions. Now, that's one of the issues that is going to be a real sticking point within the negotiations. And I'm sure this is the one which the Americans are trying somehow to get out of. And that is, they want to lift any sanctions. But of course, Iran is going to be demanding that not only are they lifted, but there are guarantees and there is a clear-cut route for the cancellation of those quite abhorrently sanctioned.
In other news, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un orders the expansion and modernization of a satellite launching station on the northwest coast. North Korean media say the order aims to ensure that various rockets could be launched to carry out multi-purpose satellites, including a military reconnaissance one. In the meantime, neighboring South Korea and its ally, the United States, say the North recently used intercontinental ballistic missiles in two secretive launches. Seoul and Washington say the ICBM system used in those tests could be the largest ever Pyongyang has. The U.S. says the tests are a serious escalation that requires a united global response. Japan also says it's considering more sanctions against the North. Pyongyang is already under crippling international sanctions over its missile and nuclear weapons program. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, explains why North Korea is expanding its aerospace program despite the pressure it has faced from the United States.
the cards are stacked up against Pyongyang, so it feels it has no choice but to develop these types of reconnaissance satellites. They need to keep track of the U.S. South Korea military exercises, which practice a preemptive strike on North Korea's nuclear and missile facilities. And they have said that this is the reason and the sole reason why they are testing these satellites. But the U.S. says that in consultation with its allies, South Korea and Japan, it has determined that the North is indeed developing intercontinental ballistic missiles, a new system of such missiles designed to strike the U.S. mainland. Now, of course, the last ICBM test the North did in 2017 was determined by experts to be capable of striking the U.S. mainland. But analysts say this new long-range missile system is more powerful than the latest one in 2017.
March 11 marks the 10th anniversary of the Kandahar massacre, on which a U.S. Army sergeant murdered 16 Afghan civilians and injured 6 others, including children in eastern Afghanistan. 10 years later, Afghanistan's public opinion is still seeking justice for the massacre. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
Back on March 11, 2012, a U.S. Army sergeant horrifically killed at least 16 civilians, including 9 children, and wounded 6 others in Panjwayi district of Kandahar province. Today, Afghans recall the killings as shocking and inhuman, saying they can't forget about the U.S. war crimes in their country.
Around 10 years ago, a terrifying shooting was carried out on my relatives in the Zangawad village in Kandahar. It was like a nightmare. I can't forget it. American forces opened fire on civilians, including children and women. We did protests against the U.S. and didn't let them sweep it under the carpet. Americans should be held accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan.
Sayed Ishaq Gilani was a former Afghan MP. He led the Afghan team to investigate the Panjwayi mass killing. He denies an individual act, saying it was planned and more Americans were involved.
Throughout our investigation, we found out that there was more than one shooter. We saw 20 footprints of the American forces at the scenes of crimes. The incident was shocking and tragic. It looked like a group of U.S. soldiers had done that. Then they blamed everything on one of their drunk teammates. The U.S. forces threatened the local people not to tell us the truth.
Sardar Muhammad, the lawyer of the victim's family, says that the U.S. Army threatened him and didn't let him pursue the file.
After the mass killing, the victim's family chose me as the lawyer. At a 2 rounds of trial, the American sergeant Robert Bales was sentenced to death, and it was what the family wanted. But before going to the last trial, Americans threatened me because I was insisting on execution of the murderer. I don't know what happened in the last trial, as the Americans selected one of themselves as the lawyer of the victim's families instead of me.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year, leaving Afghans with sad and heartbreaking memories. People in Afghanistan associate the U.S. invasion of their country with destruction, night raids, and rights violation. They say the U.S. should be held accountable for its war crimes in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turning to the U.S. now, where consumer prices hit a new 40-year high amid rising inflation in the world's largest economy. The Labor Department says the consumer price index was at nearly 8% in February compared to the same month last year. That's the biggest jump since January 1982. The rise comes as gasoline, food and housing prices have skyrocketed. The Federal Reserve is set to increase interest rates to deal with the rising inflation. It is expected that the fallout from Russia's military action in Ukraine will exacerbate the crisis. Financial experts warn of another shock as a result of the West's anti-Moscow sanctions. Russia is a major producer of oil and natural gas, as well as some food commodities. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The Limelight. New research has shown that governments and individuals making small changes can have a huge impact in reducing carbon emissions. We are prepared for you an article written by Matthew Taylor. The piece is titled Study Finds Six Key Lifestyle Changes Can Help Avert the Climate Crisis. According to new research from three leading institutions, people in well-off countries can help avert climate breakdown by making six relatively straightforward lifestyle changes. The new study found that sticking to six specific commitments, from flying no more than once every 3 years to only buying three new items of clothing a year, could rein in the runaway consumption that is partially driving the climate crisis. The new research, carried out by academics at Leeds University in England and analysed by experts at the global engineering firm Arup and the C40 group of world cities, found that making the six commitments could account for a quarter of the emissions reductions required to keep the global heating down to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. The new study was published on Monday alongside the launch of a new climate movement to persuade and support relatively well-off people to make the jump and sign up to the six pledges. Tom Bailey, co-founder of the campaign, said, "This ends once and for all the debate about whether citizens can have a role in protecting our Earth. We don't have time to wait for one group to act. We need all action from all actors now." Recently, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, issued its bleakest warning yet, saying the climate crisis was accelerating rapidly, with only a narrow chance left to avoid its worst ravages. Tom Bailey, co-founder of the campaign, said, "As the world reaches the edge of ecological collapse, it needed a workable alternative to this universal consumer society in the next decade." Tom Bailey added, "The research is clear that governments and the private sector have the largest role to play, but it is also equally clear from our analysis that individuals and communities can also make a huge difference." The Jump campaign asks people to sign up to take the following six shifts for 1, 3, or 6 months. 1. Eat a largely plant-based diet with healthy portions and no waste. 2. Buy no more than 3 new items of clothing per year. 3. Keep electrical products for at least 7 years. 4. Take no more than 1 short-haul flight every 3 years, and 1 long-haul flight every 8 years. 5. Get rid of personal motor vehicles if you can, and if not, keep hold of your existing vehicle for longer. And 6. Make at least 1 life shift to nudge the system, like moving to a green energy, insulating your home, or changing pension supplier. The campaign was officially kicked off on Saturday, 5th of February, and Tom Bailey said there was already a growing movement emerging in response to the evidence, with jump groups up and running around the country. Tom Bailey added, "This is not just new information or a normal behaviour change campaign, but a fun movement that is working to go way beyond the usual greeny suspects." He added, "A movement that is able to engage all types of people, engaging and being led by communities of colour and economically excluded." Tom Bailey said there has been a widespread belief in climate circles in recent years that individual action was relatively ineffective, and the only option was to get out on the streets and demand system change from governments and corporations, adding, "Obviously, this is still hugely important, but what this new research shows is that there is a role for a new joyful climate movement which can help lead the way to less stuff and more joy." Some of the shifts the campaign calls for are at least partially dependent on systemic change. The prohibitive cost of train fares might leave individuals with little choice but to use short-haul flights for essential journeys. Public transport may be expensive or non-existent in areas of the country, leaving people with no choice but to use their car. Tom Bailey was the lead author of Labour's plan to decarbonise the UK's energy sector at the last election. He has worked in the green energy sector in the United Kingdom, US and China for the past 15 years and said individual actions could have a cascade effect, leading to community-level action and ultimately contributing to systemic change. He said although not everyone would be able to commit to all the pledges, just making a start could have a big impact. He added, "This isn't going back to the Stone Age, it's just finding a balance. Less consuming in relatively rich Western countries can mean more creativity, comedy, connection. Live for joy, not for stuff." The research is based on a study by academics at Leeds University in England, Arup, and the C40 group of leading cities, which assesses the impact of consumption by people in the world's leading cities. Analysis of the data has found that 6 steps set out above could cut global carbon emissions by between 25% and 27%. Ben Smith, director of climate change at Arup, who led the analysis, said that as scientific evidence mounts, it was clear that all sections of society had to act. Ben Smith said, "Our research shows that all of us, from politicians, city and business leaders to individual citizens, have important roles to play. And it is clear there's lots that we can do as individuals and that this is one of the easiest and quickest places to start." Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa, via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Midstream.
Interview with The Atlantic magazine, the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman announced several unprecedented positions for those in power in the kingdom. It began with, "We do not view Israel as an enemy, but as a potential ally," and it ended with, "Iran is our neighbor forever. We cannot get rid of them, and they cannot get rid of us." Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman said last week that he sees Iran as a neighbor, where none of them is capable of canceling the other. In an interview with The Atlantic magazine, he said that he intends to continue detailed talks with Iran in order to reach a satisfactory agreement for both, while stressing the need for a strong nuclear deal between Tehran and world powers at talks in Vienna. Now, it seems Mohammed bin Salman's eyes are fixated at what could come out of Vienna and how that would affect the West's approach towards the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. However, this does not change the fact that these statements mark a significant shift in tone compared to Mohammed bin Salman's previous interviews, in which he usually lashes out against the Islamic Republic, demonizing it at every chance he gets. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Ali Murad, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, when asked about Iran, bin Salman said they are our neighbors and they will remain our neighbors forever. We cannot get rid of them and they cannot get rid of us. So it is better that we solve our issues and look for ways to be able to coexist. Well, 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 what changed his mind?
Actually, this is not a change if we take into consideration what bin Salman himself said in an interview in last April. In an interview, he said the same thing about Iran, and it turned out that bin Salman was trying to send some signals before the dialogue that took place in Baghdad between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And it turned out later, after four or five sessions of meetings between the Saudi and the Iranian delegates, that bin Salman went there for tactical reasons. He wanted from Tehran to help him in Yemen by pressing Ansarullah to save him from this war. And after he found out that he has to go to negotiate directly with Sana'a, he all the mouthpieces around him that the negotiations have collapsed, understandings with Iran. With all the on the global scene, and of course what's going on in Vienna has the concern of Saudi Arabia, because they know that the nuclear deal is about to arise, and the situation in the whole Middle East and West Asia is going to change. So Saudi Arabia has to stick to this conciliatory speech, talking about neighbors and cooperation between Iran and Saudi Arabia. But again, I don't think that Mohammed bin Salman is really convinced that cooperating with Iran is a positive thing for the region. He is still looking labeling Iran as an enemy or a rival in the region. And because if you take a look at the steps he's taking towards the Zionist entity, we can clearly conclude that he is still having hostile thoughts about Iran.
Well, we will talk about what he said about Israel, but observers saw that his sweet talk, just as you explained to us now, Ms. Ali, that his sweet talk with Iran might be just a maneuver that he is using against the Biden administration, which he spoke of in disdain in this article in The Atlantic. And then he mentioned that the kingdom is heading east. As some sort of a threat. He thinks that he's threatening the United States' interests in the kingdom in retaliation to Biden's position from Mohammed bin Salman's approach to the rule inside the kingdom of Saudi Arabia and towards his approach to his neighbors as well. What's your take on this kind of tactic? Will he be successful in this?
Actually, what bin Salman is doing with Washington, with this speech that is not well known as a Saudi speech toward Washington, we see that historically Saudi leaders stick to this tactic before. King Abdullah, late King Abdullah, used the same tactic with President Bush back in 2003 when he went to Moscow and he claimed that he is going to buy Saudi Russian arms. And there is a shift in Saudi policy, but it turned out that Saudi Arabia by then wanted something from Washington, and when they got it from the Americans, things went back to normal, to the normal relation between Riyadh and Washington. I think that bin Salman is trying to tell Biden that I want something from you. Primarily, he wants Joe Biden personally to contact him. And by the way, some news outlets today, they are reporting that some Biden aides are studying or examining whether Joe Biden might travel to Saudi Arabia next spring. Washington is clearly that they want Saudi Arabia on their bench regarding the oil prices now with the with their moves towards against Russia and
European dependence on the Russian oil. Biden did say that he's sending aid and he might even himself visit Venezuela if that's the case because of gas prices. So why not do it with Saudi Arabia? So this could actually be a win-win for Saudi Arabia, you're saying?
Actually, Saudi Arabia is a winner now regarding the crisis taking place in the energy market, because as Saudi Arabia sticks to the OPEC Plus agreement with the Russians, energy prices are still skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. So Saudi Arabia is having a lot of gains and returns from the high prices. And also Washington, actually Mohammed bin Salman is trying to higher his price to the Americans. That's what he's really trying to do.
It's just business for him then. But
exactly.
What you're saying is that this is just a maneuver. It's a tactic by Mohammed bin Salman. It has nothing to do with real intentions towards Iran. And your evidence is his rapprochement towards Israel, because finally, Mohammed bin Salman admitted that Israel is not only not his enemy, but also rather his potential ally.
Yes.
This is not really a surprise, to be honest with you, but what is ambiguous to me, what he meant by saying that Israel has to solve what he referred to as conflict with Palestinians. How would he suggest that they resolve this conflict?
For bin Salman, it's the way that the Zionists do it in Palestine doesn't really matter to him. Maybe he is referring to the colonial moves that Tel Aviv is doing in the West Bank and Eastern Jerusalem, Al-Quds. I believe that bin Salman, with reference to what he did in 2017 and 2018 when we were talking about the deal of the century, he was pressuring Palestinians, even President Mahmoud Abbas and also other Palestinian factions. So I believe that bin Salman is telling the Zionists that as soon as you finish the job, we will declare the alliance with you. The job means that more cleansing, ethnic cleansing, more grabbing of the lands of the Palestinians in the West Bank. And by the way, what is taking place in Ukraine is helping the Zionists somehow, because they are bringing those Jews from Ukraine to colonize them on, mm-hmm. on Palestine, and they are also pushing forward against the Palestinians and taking their homes in eastern Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and also in the West Bank. So maybe this is the situation that MBS prefers mm-hmm. to see in Palestine, so that the circumstances are fruiting for him to declare the alliance.
Well, it seems that it's just a matter of time now for him to actually declare that. I want to thank you very much, Ali Murad, political commentator, for joining us to talk about this issue and the new approach of Mohammed bin Salman towards the regional conflict, if I may. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will talk how water might create peace in West Asia.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Water to Create Peace, a content that was revived during the meetings of the Blue Peace Initiative at Dubai Expo 2020 recently, to create the necessary regional cooperation in the party states within the Harmonious Initiative, achieve sustainable development goals, and transform water into a tool towards peace after the COVID pandemic disrupted the acceleration of its pace. The Mideast Stream took part in the meetings along with the participants in the Water and Peace Dialogues, which were held by the Foundation for Media Through Cooperation and Transformation, MICT, in cooperation and with the support of the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation, SDC, in Dubai last week. Attendees of the Blue Peace Initiative stressed the need to proceed with building the necessary confidence between the member states, namely Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, while accentuating the necessity of having Iran on board too in the Water Initiative, calling for resolving transboundary water issues within peaceful solutions. More in this following report.
Countries in West Asia are concerned about the challenges of water resources resulting from the repercussions of climate change, population growth, increased migration, and changes in land use patterns. This prompted regional and international effort to find quick solutions before the water crisis in the region worsens. The Blue Peace Initiative held an extensive conference at the Dubai Expo 2020 last week to find the necessary proposals and solutions under the auspices of the Media Through Cooperation and Transformation MICT Foundation and with the support of the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation SDC, with a large international presence over a period of 2 days. The Mideast Stream was invited by the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation SDC to take part in the events held in Dubai to follow up on the agency's work in implementing and supporting several projects at the regional level in the areas of education and building peace and water-related operations as the main issue of the greatest challenge of securing water, peace and stability in the region for the next 50 years. This prompted the launching of the Blue Peace Initiative in 2010, and which worked to introduce an innovative approach to water resource experts from riparian countries. Member states in this initiative, Syria, Iraq, Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, had all agreed to goals of the Blue Peace Initiative as it encourages cooperation in the field of water and promoting peace, stability, and sustainable development in the region. During a press conference held by the Director General of the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation, SDC, Patricia Danzi, she explained that the agency seeks to build a broader Blue Peace Initiative to reach water diplomacy in addition to other discussions. When asked about the role of Iran in this initiative, Danzi said that it is important for the SDC to include Iran on board as a permanent member of the Blue Peace Initiative in order to advance water cooperation and focus on the need to provide information about water, in addition to raising the efficiency of water management and developing the level of dialogue in this regard. The Blue Peace Initiative, which stresses that water diplomacy is the only effective mechanism that directly touches the lives of communities and people, views that the need to manage transboundary waters entails the necessity to integrate society with decision makers. The Blue Peace meetings in Dubai were of great benefit to member states by strengthening relations with upstream countries and introducing proposals for solutions, especially with the agreement concluded with the Turkish side to establish a joint research center for water management in Baghdad. In conclusion, the main message SDC stressed was that the Blue Peace Initiative maintains that any two countries engaged in active water cooperation do not go to war, highlighting the strong correlation between the degree of cooperation over water and the general atmosphere of peace and friendship between any two or more countries.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Amman is Mr. Andre Verli, Senior Water Policy Advisor at the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation. Thank you very much for being with us, Andre. Now, as the world is facing an unprecedented global water crisis, it is important to utilize water management and water cooperation as a catalyst for sustainable development and peace, particularly in West Asia, where many countries share water resources or are riparian states. How can Blue Peace, which we just watched a report about, play a role in reducing this regional crisis?
Thank you very much. Let me start with just again introducing what Blue Peace is. It is a diplomatic initiative launched by Switzerland that promotes water cooperation across border sectors and generations to foster peace, stability, and sustainable socioeconomic development. Blue Peace is based on the recognition that sustainable solutions for the water sector at large lay also beyond the water sector itself. At the end, we are not just talking water, but we are talking about water as a matter of survival. This is, by the way, also the title of a report that was published back in 2017, which includes several recommendations of the Global High-Level Panel on Water and Peace. So how can Blue Peace in West Asia play a role in reducing the water crisis that you refer to? Mm-hmm. First, it tries to bring people together to exchange on common problems and potential solutions. Since 2019, the core piece of the Blue Peace Initiative in the region is the so-called regional mechanism, which brings together experts from different countries. As a basis for exchanges and discussions, Blue Peace also supports the elaboration of baseline studies, as was, for example, done for the Yarmouk Basin. Such studies can then inform concrete exchanges between countries, between governments, as was the case for Yarmouk. Moreover, capacity development of institutions and people is fostered by Blue Peace in the region. Mm-hmm. The recently created Water Diplomacy Center at the Jordan University for Science and Technology is a good example hereof. It is something like a spin-off of the study that was done in Yarmouk, and now it exists and can thus contribute to increasing the capacities on water diplomacy and integrated water resources management in the region.
Well, Mr. Andre, we did meet a lot of high-level officials throughout the years in the Blue Peace, and especially in the Dubai Expo last week, speaking about the importance of this initiative. And several times during the meeting network, especially the media network meetings and the high-level meetings with officials from member states and from the hosting Swiss side as well, we heard the necessity of getting Iran on board this initiative. In what ways do you think that Iran's presence can help promote transboundary water management in West Asia, and where would be a good start at the official or the expert level to get Iran on board?
Yes, we really think that it would be absolutely great to get Iran on board of the Blue Peace Initiative. Iran is geographically something like at the heart of Western Asia, and it is as well a downstream country as it is an upstream country. And at the same time, Iran is also suffering very much from climate change, which very often translates into concrete impacts related to water. Too much water as in floods, or too few water as in droughts. And as climate change, water does not really know man-made borders. In fact, water rather unites than it separates. And if it is well managed, the shared benefits for all are likely to be higher than the costs for each. So how could we get Iran on board? A good start could be if Iran would be willing to join the regional mechanism. Mm-hmm. This platform and think tank brings together the experts, I mentioned it before, and it is led by a management committee, which includes two members of each participating country so far, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. Mm-hmm. I cannot speak on behalf of the committee, as Switzerland is only observer in the committee, but I'm pretty sure that the door is wide open to have Iran on board mm-hmm. in the management committee. And as a member of the management committee, Iran could then bring in its priorities related to water in a large sense. That could, for example, include the mitigation of climate change impacts, such as dust storms. And we know that Iran is suffering from mm-hmm. dust storms.
Well, Andre, SDC Director Patricia Dunsey said that Switzerland has a long history of promoting transboundary water cooperation and is committed to supporting countries in achieving sustainable access to clean water. I personally had an inquiry about how can politics be split from such a complex issue like water in a world that is highly polarized politically, especially in our part of the world where sanctions, warfare, and occupation are very much our daily bread.
Well, without political will, you will not come very far, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. As the former president of Slovenia and speaker at the high-level event of the Blue Peace Days in Dubai, Dr. Danilo Turk said, the future of water requires vision and political will for ambitious programs. So, of course, you can take specific action in a smaller setting to improve or try to improve the access to water or sanitation for a certain community or for a city. But also here, you will ultimately need to rely on political will if you want to have this established in a sustainable manner. So, therefore, the political will absolutely needs to be fostered, and this will take time and perseverance. But there are different entry points that you can actually use. So, first, of course, you can and have to make people aware about what is at stake and how you could potentially move from competition over resources towards shared benefits. And you have to change the water narrative. It's not about water allocation, definitely not, but it's really about life, sustainable economic development, stability, and ultimately also peace. Changing that narrative based on solid scientific data is an important step to change mindsets. For this part of awareness raising, obviously the media are crucial, but you can also think of other entry points, other agents of change. Youth, for example. The young generation of today, they will inherit the mess that we will leave them. Mm-hmm. So you have to get them involved in education, for example, by bringing them together. And education, if you take education, you can do that at a very early stage in mm-hmm. primary school, just to make them aware about what is at stake. Apart from awareness raising, we need to strengthen the capacity of the people. Here again, sound baselines based on shared scientific data and information could play a key role. And finally, we need to bring people together so that they can see and learn from each other.
Well,
and
it
Blue
sounds,
Peace tries to cover that.
Andre, it really sounds like something to build on for the future of this region. I want to thank you very much from Amman, Mr. Andre Verli, Senior Water Policy Advisor at the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation, for joining us and explaining what Blue Peace Initiative is and how important it is to put it on the train of the West Asian part of the world. Thank you very much for your contribution, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream, and I'll see you next week.
in the limelight.
The Netherlands has ended funding to the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, one of six Palestinian organizations recently declared as terrorist groups by the fake regime of Israel. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is titled "Dutch Double Standards: Punish Palestinians, Embrace Zionist Regime." Stay tuned for more. The Netherlands has ended funding to the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, one of six Palestinian organizations recently declared as terrorist groups by the fake regime of Israel. The implications of the Dutch move will reverberate throughout Palestinian civil society, which is under unprecedented attack by the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime accuses the prominent human rights and social services organizations of serving as front groups for the Popular Front of the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party banned by the Zionist regime, the US and EU. The targeted groups reject the Zionist regime's claims and have demanded that Tel Aviv provide the evidence that it claims justifies by the sweeping measure. Recently, the Zionist regime responded by saying that it would allow the groups to review only the unclassified material on which it is basing the designations. In its response, the Zionist regime's military attorney stated that the core of the declarations is based on classified, cross-checked, and reliable intelligence confirmation that cannot be disclosed, as it may harm security. The Zionist regime's response shows that the targeted groups are afforded no due process rights. Adala, a group providing legal representation,